Welcome to In Your Right Mind, a weekly discussion of behavioral health issues that affect our lives. We all have issues, so let's start talking. Welcome to In Your Right Mind, a weekly discussion of behavioral health issues that affect our lives. We all have issues, so let's start talking. My name is Stephanie Wilder-Taylor.
And I'm Dr. Tonmoy Sharma.
Today, we're talking about bad habits and how they're hardwired into our brain. So every December 31st, millions of people around the world resolve to quit a bad habit, right? Like nail biting, eating junk food, drinking too much, even procrastinating. And by January 2nd, most people have already given up. In fact, according to the University of Scranton, only 8% of those who make New Year's resolutions actually keep them. And that number actually sounds high to me. Dr. Sharma, have you tried to break any bad habits?
Yeah, continuously. Like not eating pizza.
Okay.
We had pizza for lunch, I think.
Okay, well.
And then controlling my weight. I need to, my primary care physician says, well, I need to make sure I control my weight. Something I struggle about. So habits are something we look at as things that we have control over, but do we really have control over them?
I don't know.
Are they hardwired into our brains?
Let's find out.
Okay. So with us today, we have to help us understand all this and how we are, or as to whether we are creatures of habit or whether we are able to control our destiny. We have Dr. James Claiborne. Dr. Claiborne is the author of the Habit Change Workbook, How to Break Bad Habits and Form Good Ones. He has a private practice in Maine where he specializes in treating OCD, that's obsessive compulsive disorder, a body dysmorphic disorder, and related problems such as a tic disorder, including Tourette's disorder. I don't know if you know what Tourette's is. It's when you, amongst other things, swear words that are involuntarily spoken out. Trichotillomania, where you're pulling and you might be even eating hair. And compulsive skin picking.
This is going to be a good show. Also in studio is Nkem Indefo, who is the founder and president of Lumos Transforms and creator of the Resilience Toolkit. Nkem is certified as a registered nurse and nurse midwife and also has extensive postgraduate training in complementary health modalities and emotional therapies. She's maintained a holistic health private practice in Los Angeles since 2001. So I want to start with Dr. Claiborne. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Let's establish what exactly we mean when we talk about bad habits.
Well, I start with what I mean by a habit, and a habit is a learned behavior that is essentially repeated or occurs at some regular frequency. It is essentially something you should understand as an automatic behavior or what psychologists might call overlearned, which is to say that we do it often without even really being aware that we're doing it.
Right. And when do you think bad habits go from just a habit to a destructive behavior or an addiction?
Well, I think what would define a bad habit, and that's kind of a tough word in some ways, but what defines a bad habit is that it's having more adverse consequences than benefits. If you bite your nails on a rare occasion when you've got a particular piece of nail sticking out somewhere that is getting caught on things and you don't have your nail clippers handy, that's not a bad habit. If you're spending a lot of time chewing on your nails and your fingers are bloody and so forth, I figure we'd probably call that a bad habit.
Right.
But to what extent does something that's a habit go on to become an addiction? So, for example, eating could be, you could like eating, And then that, when does that become a food addiction? So a lot of people can identify with that. So we don't have to use other substances like alcohol or drugs, which might be things that people may not use. But every one of us has to eat to survive, I guess. So when does one...
You're fading out for me a little bit.
So when does one look at, you know, if you look at food as a substance, we need food to survive. So how does one, you know, where does one go from eating and enjoying food to having a habit of overeating to then addiction? So in that sort of continuum.
Well, okay. I think, first of all, behaviors like eating are usually under the control of things like hunger, okay? And if you're eating in response to hunger and stop eating after you've consumed a reasonable amount of food and you're not hungry anymore, then it's not going to be a problem. If it somehow gets out of that kind of regulation or control, then it may well become a problem habit or a bad habit, if you will, and begin to have adverse effects on our health. If you look at people who have eating disorders, whether it's a binge eating disorder or a restricting eating disorder, it looks very much like their eating is not under the control of hunger, but under the control of something else.
Right. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. We're exploring how bad habits get hardwired into our brain with the author of the Habit Change Workbook and founder and president of Lumos Transforms. So, Nkem, tell us about Lumos Transforms and how you do work with people who have maybe destructive behavior patterns.
We look at habits as a lot of times people have high stress and they're trying to soothe and settle. And many of those forms may be bad habits. They may be not so, they have a need for security. They have a need for nurturance. We all do. We're stressed out. And that they're using strategies to meet those that may not be, for example, as Dr. Sharma said, overeating. Right. So the eating is not under control of hunger. It's for soothing.
Right.
It's for and so when we look at that, we say, well, the root cause here is actually the overactive stress response.
Right.
And if we can get to the stress response and use better tools to settle the stress, then we actually find that the habit goes away because the need goes away.
Right. So if all habits are self-soothing, let's just say, do they all need to be broken? Because, for instance, I like to play this game on my phone, Bejeweled, if you must know. And, I mean, I will play it compulsively. But I have also quit drinking about 8 years ago, so I've stopped doing some destructive habits. And I feel like just, you know, zoning out and playing a game on my phone is soothing to me. My husband finds it aggravating. And he says I do it way too much.
So this begs your question about when does it become an addiction?
Right.
So I would say that line is when you crave it, when you don't have it, mm-hmm. when you stop, there's some withdrawals, you get kind of cranky, and you find that you need more and more of it. And then it's crossed the line between being just a habit and it's actually having deleterious effects because you're seeing the tolerance grow, you're seeing the withdrawal and the craving.
But I can control it. I can quit any time.
Right. No. Addiction has certain components, as you've just heard, that there's a withdrawal component, there's a tolerance component. And so a habit could be something that we are just used to, we like doing something. So habits are there and we are comfortable with those things. And so you like playing this game, yes. But if it is interfering with your life, if it has become something that is interfering with your relationship, then that's something you've got to examine and say, even if you're not, quote-unquote, addicted to it, this is hampering your life and your relationship, and that's something one needs to worry about.
But I think I feel like I have to do something to unwind, and if you look at the other things that I could be doing that aren't healthy for me, I feel like I'm a person who needs to do something to unwind, get that quiet time, be it, you know, zoning out and watching TV or playing my little game. So how do I convince my husband that it's not a problem? That I need it.
You can tell him you're not smoking pot.
On the spectrum, it's not that harmful. And I think we have to have some compassion around that is a better choice. The question is helping you to identify the need for your alone time, your need for downtime, and then actually ask, is Bejeweled really giving you the best of that, or is there something that could be better? And my guess is there's something better, and that choosing that in a more intentional way may actually meet that need, and you find the need for Bejeweled to go down.
That is very interesting. We need to go to a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about why exactly habits are so hard to break. You're listening to In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Want to get the latest information regarding mental illness, substance abuse, and more? Then get hooked on Hook Sober, a group of sobers who have been hooked on updating you with the latest trends regarding behavioral health and addiction. Want to check them out? Go to HookedSober.com. That's HookedSober.com. And get hooked, because recovery is possible in all cases.
Hello, hello.
We're going to try to give away some money.
Ooh, let's do this.
We're the laggards. You realize this? We're the losers.
We suck.
I mean, for God's sakes, Tilden gave away money. Come on. Raymond, don't blow this. Take our money. What number do you want to play?
I'm going to go with 23.
Yes! 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 Finally! Woo! Finally, somebody picked our pocket.
Thank you guys so much.
All right. Try not to get too excited.
The winning is just beginning. You could be next. Listen for the cue to call between 6 and 6. If you're caller 7 and give us the lucky number, we'll give you $500 cash. That's 500 more reasons to listen to the louder, clearer, and very generous 790 KABC.
We are back with In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. I'm Stephanie Wilder-Taylor, and we're talking about habits with our guests, Dr. James Claiborne, author of the Habit Change Workbook, and Nkem Indefo, president and founder of Lumos Transforms and the creator of the Resilience Toolkit. Dr. Claiborne, you have said that all voluntary behavior is operant. What do you mean by that?
I say that regularly. What I mean is that all voluntary behavior is essentially maintained or controlled in large part by its consequences. So psychologists like to talk about things like reinforcement, and that's largely the same concept, that if I continue to engage in a behavior, it's paying off, it's getting reinforced. And if we want to change a behavior, we need to understand that and potentially, among other things, manipulate reinforcement phenomenon in our environment.
So if people, so basically you're saying that when you do something, have a habit, you're getting something out of it.
Yes.
Well, what I want to hear what you both think about something like chronic lateness. This is a bad habit of my husband. And I feel like both of you guys have a slightly different take on it. He is always late. Since I've known him, I've learned to accept it. But where does that come from? What's he getting out of it?
You think you have nothing to do with it?
I'm a very timely person. And he will wait until the last possible moment. I start getting more and more anxious, going, he does this every time. He waits until he's late. Basically, he almost waits till the time he's supposed to be somewhere. And then all of a sudden, he says, oh, my God, I have to go.
So, one, is it cultural? Right?
No.
Okay. got that one out. I think it's when people are in a high stress state, they're in fight flight, they've got a lot of adrenaline pumping, and there's a sense of hurry and contracted time, and you're trying to squeeze everything in. And in that way, that's actually, that state produces more lateness. Because you said he's trying to get all those things in. He's trying to, at the very last minute, go. And that's what makes the lateness. And so actually, I would, you know, in working with someone like your husband, is to help him identify that he's stressed and actually early on interrupt the stress cycle. And actually, we know when we're on vacation, when we're calm, time seems to extend. There's plenty of time and we don't have that hurry. And often that lateness goes away.
But I feel like I'm hearing what you're saying, but I feel like he's relaxed until I feel like he waits. I feel like he almost does it to himself on purpose. Is that possible? Is he getting something out of being late, some payoff?
Well, we get addicted to our stress chemicals for sure.
That's interesting.
You know, if I can jump in here, a couple of possibilities occur to me. I mean, if we look at how his being late affects other things, like other people, or like it affects you, for example, that may have an impact on when he's late. If you want to actually to understand it completely, gather some data about does it occur all the time? Does it occur in certain situations and not others? What is the typical effect of being late or hurrying, rushing around? Does it get other people to do things for him? Does it
find his keys?
Change the situation somehow, any of those things may well impact a particular behavior like being late all the time.
Dr. Claiborne, when I was talking to you before, you were saying something about sort of an OCD, that some people are late because they can't stop doing the thing that they're doing.
Well, yeah, tell a story about when I first started working with people with OCD, many, many years ago, I was very puzzled by the fact that they were typically late to their appointments, because you'd think that, you know, people who were compulsive would be precisely on time. And I talked to my boss at the time, who was a person who had done some research and work on OCD, and he said, oh, they're just stuck doing compulsions. Turns out he was right, that oftentimes people with OCD are late everywhere because they can't get out of the house, because they got to go back and check on the stove, or because they, on the way over, drove around the block 6 times to make sure they hadn't run somebody over.
That's so interesting. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma, and we're exploring how bad habits get hardwired into our brain with the author of the Habit Change Workbook and founder and president of Lumos Transforms. And Dr. Claiborne, you wrote a 10-page paper on skin picking. Why do you think skin picking is such a difficult behavior for people to stop?
Well, it again, it's a behavior that in the short term is reinforcing, because what it looks like is a grooming behavior kind of thing that we see across species, but that apparently has some kind of soothing or tension-reducing effect. And it has that effect in the short term. In the long term, it produces all kinds of problems, like, you know, have patients that are recovered with unhealed wounds because they've been picking at them continuously, or who can't go places or can't wear shorts because their legs are so scarred or picked at, won't go to the beach because they'd have to be seen, spend a lot of time not going out at all because their face is a mess. But in the short term, again, the behavior is typically reducing some dysphoric, uncomfortable state, maybe anxiety, maybe boredom, or something else. But it continuously works that way. It works automatically rather than requiring intervention of somebody else or some other system.
Can I admit something to you guys? I have the skin picking thing. I know, I'm gonna admit to everything. I don't ever talk about this publicly, but look, I'm showing the in studio. I have these little, it's not severe, but I do a little thing where I think I find a little whisker on my side of my jaw, and I try to get it out, and I will do it until it bleeds. I know this is disgusting, no, and I have a lot of shame around it, but it's very automatic. You guys were talking about automatic behaviors, and every time I've tried to stop, like, my husband would try to point it out to me, and then I would get embarrassed, and I would try not to do it. But it's, I can't even explain it to you guys if you've never had a thing like that. I have to do it.
So do you notice the times when you're, when you do it? Like, when it's brought to your attention, I think finding, oh, I was actually super stressed about something, or I was really worried about something.
Yes, always when I'm stressed is when I do it.
Okay. And so then that's really important. So what kind of processes or practices could you do to... There she is, relaxing her shoulders.
Relax myself.
Relaxing her shoulders. What kind of processes or practices could you do that would help you bring attention to your level of stress on a more regular basis and do something about it? Go for a walk, you know, hop on the phone, do something that preemptively, before it gets to the level that you're unconsciously picking at your skin.
I think I might be speaking for a lot of listeners. That I'm so busy, though. It's hard to find time to take care of myself. I have three young kids. You know, I have a really busy life and schedule. So I feel like sometimes I just feel like, God, if picking at my chin is like a way that I can like zone out for a minute, then is it that bad? But then I do it and then I feel like, oh, God, I made another little, got to put more makeup on that. Do you find that, Dr. Claiborne? Is it hard to treat this kind of behavior?
Yeah, absolutely. The skin picking, per se, is now a disorder with a name. We call it excoriation, and as of a couple of years ago when the most recent version of the DSM came out, it was included as an OCD-related disorder. But it is a very difficult disorder to treat, and these days people start to talk about a collection of related kinds of problems. We call them body-focused repetitive behaviors that, you know, essentially usually serve that same sort of function. They're anxiety-reducing or tension-reducing or somehow otherwise soothing behaviors that have, unfortunately, destructive consequences. So we have to look at, you know, when is it happening, under what conditions. Lots of people won't pick in front of anybody else. But, you know, they'll go in the bathroom or somewhere where they're alone. Lots of people will describe doing it in an almost trance-like state where they find the results of a long period of it and, you know, haven't really been aware of what they were doing while they were doing it.
That's me.
It's also a disorder which, even if people stop, and this is a problem with a lot of bad habits, but even if people stop and then they slip up and do start doing it again, we get a big relapse, abstinence violation effect is what it's called in the substance abuse literature, but we get this relapse back into the full-fledged disorder very quickly. And then people get very discouraged and say, I can't control it.
That's, I felt like that.
So, Dr. Claiborne, we have these OCD spectrum disorders. They go up in terms of severity from things that one might be able to control to things that are really very difficult to live with. And I don't know how, what you'd advise our listeners in terms of potential treatments. We're looking at what are the potential causative factors, and you mentioned operant conditioning.
Most effective treatment that we've got, and it doesn't have as successful an outcome as we'd like it to, but is a behavioral treatment that's referred to as habit reversal. And there are a couple of elements in that. One of them is actually training people to be aware of when they are engaging in the behavior, as well as being aware of the things that lead up to it. So if you're talking about picking at your skin on your face, before you do that, you're going to bring your hand up to your face. Well, if you're doing that without being aware of it, then you're likely to get started on the picking without being aware of that either. If we can help you become aware of what you're doing with your hands, when you be aware of what you're doing when you're picking, secondly, we want to look at what's called a competing response. That is to say, we train people to engage in some behavior that is incompatible with the problem behavior, and ask them to try to hold on to that behavior. With picking your skin, it could be something as simple as clenching your fists, and hold that behavior, hold the clenched fist, for example, for 2 minutes, which it turns out to be a very long time to clench your fist.
I'm doing it right now.
What happens is that there's an underlying urge that people are not paying attention to either, to do the picking that rises and falls. And if they can get through an episode of having that urge rise and fall, and during that be aware of and acknowledge that urge, and then experience that it's fallen, only it'll rise again. But if you get through successive episodes of it rising and falling, you learn that you don't have to give in.
That's so interesting. We need to go to a break, but when we come back, we're going to give you more concrete tools to break those pesky habits once and for all. You're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Todd Moy Sharma on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Stay tuned.
Nearly half of all Americans experience at least one mental illness at some point in their lives. Sovereign Health offers treatment programs for a large spectrum of issues, including depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, and eating disorders. Let us help you heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has your unique qualities and meets your treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Coming up on The Next Drive Home with Jillian Barber and John Phillips, Jillian's back from vacation, and Martin Shkreli might be on the next season of Orange is the New Black.
Ew, he's the worst.
Disgusting.
Live and local right after Dr. Drew and Mike Hathaway right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
What's up, John? SMU in Dallas, Plano. It used to do a memorial every year for 9/11.
Yeah.
And the amount of victims that actually died, they would put up an American, small American flag, like in a courtyard there at the campus.
Uh-huh.
They are not doing it this year because of how it might potentially offend some students.
Huh?
Well, what does that mean? A 9/11 memorial?
Then we can't have any memorials for anything because anything might offend anybody.
Dr. Drew. Midday Live with Mike Catherwood. Weekdays noon to 3 on KABC.
Welcome back to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Todd Moy Sharma and me, Stephanie Wilder Taylor. We're talking to Nkem Indefo, president and founder of Lumos Transforms and the creator of the Resilience Toolkit, and Dr. James Claiborne, psychiatrist and author of the Habit Change Workbook. Nkem, how can people implement some of the tools that you teach to help them break a habit entirely or switch to something healthier?
So the first thing we teach is learning how to recognize where your own nervous system is, learning when are you calm and how does it feel? When are you getting stressed? How stressed are you? And knowing how that feels mentally, emotionally, physically in your body, and how your behavior, what your behavior looks like. And from there, based on the level of stress in your system, is to choose a mindfulness or a movement practice to settle your system, and also be aware of what does it feel like when your system settles, when you yawn and your eyes water and your muscles relax and you sigh, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when people become aware of where they are through the day, there's a lot more choice that comes in. It's like, because sometimes your response is actually
perfectly appropriate to the situation. But sometimes it's not, and then we end up playing Bejeweled to settle it down, but it was mindless as opposed to being intentional. And so the tools that we bring in include some traditional mindfulness tools, but for example, many people say, oh, I can't meditate, right? You hear that? I can't meditate. Oh, I go crazy. My mind's going crazy. And that often is, we're talking about insight meditation, where people are learning to sort of take stock of what's inside. If your stress level is very, very high, you may be numbed out. You may be overwhelmed, and having to tune into what's going in actually will make you worse. So you need a different tool, maybe orienting to your environment, noticing what do you hear, what do you see, what do you smell, taste, what do you feel on your skin. That alone can settle before you go and reach for a habit. So I had a gentleman in a class this past week who's smoking. And he says, you know, there's so many automatic places I reach to smoke. I reach to smoke after eating a nice meal. I reach to smoke after all these things. So the suggestion that we talked about was, he's now more aware of his nervous system. What would happen if right before he reached to smoke, he did a scan and noticed, whoa, I'm really stressed out, and instead did one of the movement techniques to settle his system and then see, did he want a cigarette still?
Right. That makes sense to me. But that would be, you'd have to be motivated, right? That would be someone who's motivated to quit smoking. Well, Dr. Claiborne, do you feel that people have to be very motivated to change a behavior?
Well, obviously they need to be motivated at some level. Motivation, though, always struck me as an interesting concept, because we infer motivation from what people do. And they say, well, how did they manage to quit smoking? Well, obviously they were motivated. Well, why didn't they quit? Well, they weren't motivated. It begins to get a little bit circular. I think it's very important to look at what it is that we're trying to accomplish with a behavior, and is there another way to accomplish it? Then maybe we can demonstrate that the alternative behavior has some advantages, like not causing the destruction that the picking or whatever we're talking about does, the smoking, but gets you the same thing. But there's also an implied assumption in most of what people look at when they look at stress and things like that, and that is that you have to get rid of uncomfortable emotions, or you have to not be angry or anxious or sad or whatever. That, in a sense, people spend an awful lot of time and effort trying to avoid feeling. And that's a problem, because the more you try to avoid it, the more of a problem it is that you've got it.
Right. And, Kim, you're nodding your head. You agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, but I think no one really avoids more than they need to. We avoid because it's too much. We don't have the capacity. And I believe teaching people ways to safely embody and start feeling is super important. And I really like what Dr. Kleinberg said about motivation, because many people may have motivation, but again, not the capacity to put it into play.
I wonder whether as a society we have come to expect a solution, almost an automatic solution to everything. That it is not okay to be sad. It is not okay to be uncomfortable with something. So that this sort of medicalization of our emotions, that it's normal to feel sad, to feel happy, there is this whole undulation of our mood that needs to be there within these normal standard deviations, so to speak. So, Dr. Claiborne, at some point during either this segment or next segment, I want to explore something with you. We have talked about how we need to be able to change, to do things to be able to change our habits. Whilst you were talking about that, Tourette's syndrome came to mind, and how I remember at the National Hospital in Queen Square in London, I saw a few patients with Tourette's. We had a special clinic there. This is years ago in the 90s, where there was And these people were obviously, they were sitting outside in the waiting area and compulsively swearing. You know, they're compulsively swearing the most obscene words. And that's the characteristic, as you know, of the illness itself. And they had obviously no control over their, or, you know, over the fact that they were swearing. So I'm wondering in situations like that, how you would advise that, you know, what kind of treatments and what you would do.
First of all, I want to say I certainly agree with the things that you were saying earlier about how we come to expect that it's not okay to be sad or angry or whatever. In terms of treating Tourette's, the kind of thing that I would want to do is encapsulated under another catchy name. We call it CBIT, which is Comprehensive Behavioral Intervention for Tics. Both vocal tics in Tourette's, where sometimes include cursing or whatever, sometimes include making sounds like coughing or chirping or whooping or whooping or things like that, as well as motor tics, which involve rapid, sudden, sort of purposeless movements. The person typically experiences what's called a premonitory urge. They feel a sense of tension. Sometimes it's in the muscles. Sometimes it's what's often described as a mental itch. But they get this uncomfortable feeling, and then the tic actually produces some relief of that. Typically it's described as uncontrollable or involuntary, except that people with tics sometimes can go long periods of time suppressing their tics and then get into another situation where the social consequences are different and begin to express them. So that the notion that they're uncontrollable is a little bit off target, as far as I can see. And interestingly enough, I was talking about habit reversal before. Habit reversal also is a central part of the CBIT kind of treatment for tics, in which we teach people to be aware of those premonitory sensations. We teach them a competing response. We do awareness training. May throw in some mindfulness and some relaxation kinds of things, and even look at, are there other environmental payoffs? I talked about payoffs for habits before. Are there other environmental payoffs for the ticking behavior? You wouldn't think there are, but they sometimes have important social consequences that we can manipulate or modify to help control tic disorders. For vocal tics, whether it's actually saying a swear word or just coughing, barking, or whooping, often we engage people in a controlled breathing for a period of time, and like other competing responses, have them do it long enough that the urge passes, and with repeated practice doing that, can get a dramatic reduction in the amount of ticking behavior.
Do you think this works with kids as well? I ask because 2 out of 3 of my kids have tics. Facial, one of them has blinking, and one of them does like a movement with her mouth sometimes. And I notice it's worse when they're tired.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them don't know they're doing it.
Well, you know, and again, sometimes tics are not real obvious to the person doing them. Sometimes they are. Again, the treatment for tics that I just described has actually been studied in a couple of fairly large studies done by folks down at Harvard, and they have a variation of it for kids and a variation of it for adults, and it works quite well in both populations. You modify it a little bit depending on the age, developmental level of the individual, but some of the things I was talking about in terms of external rewards in kids. Part of what you're working on is actually paying them off for making a good effort at applying the competing response when they are taking things like that. But as you say, if the kids are not even aware of it, then the first thing that you have to start with is learning to catch it and, again, catch the leading up to it sensation, the premonitory urge, because you want them to begin applying the competing response before the tick has started.
Got it. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. We've been exploring how bad habits get hardwired into our brains with the author of the Habit Change Workbook and the president of Lumos Transforms. And we have to take one more break. But when we come back, we will discuss more about this and how to break our habits. And we'll talk about when some habits are just too hard to break. You're listening to In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Be right back.
Roughly 100 million Americans suffer from chronic pain. This problem is not only excruciating, but it also takes a hit on the individual's relationships with others. Here at Sovereign Health's Chronic Pain Program, our experts target and treat the underlying causes of the problem while also helping our patients discover the best pain reduction methods that work for them. Let us help you heal. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297 or online at sovhealth.com.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring. Support us at 4-H.org.
We're back with In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. I'm Stephanie Wilder-Taylor. We're talking about habits with our guests, Dr. James Claiborne, author of the Habit Change Workbook, and Nkem Indefo, president and founder of Lumos Transforms and the creator of the Resilience Toolkit. Dr. Sharma.
What about this myth that it takes 21 days to break your habit?
No. No.
Go ahead.
Some people are really easy habit formers.
Right.
And some people, it's very tough. I think it depends under what kind of duress that habit is,
mm-hmm.
what kind of secondary benefits you're getting from the habit.
Right.
I would say, you know, some people it's a day, some people it's 5 years.
Right.
Yeah.
To break a habit?
Effectively, and it's gone, right?
It's about behaviors we have learned that under certain circumstances, and then I think when those circumstances present themselves and certain stressful situations present themselves, we almost automatically go back to those behaviors. That if you started doing certain things under a stressful circumstance and then that got you some kind of relief, whatever sense, and the same kind of stress came up. So, Dr. Claiborne, any thoughts on that? It's almost if it was, you know, this is about the learning theory.
Well, I think, you know, the things that I've been talking about in terms of rewards or payoffs and reinforcement and things like that are really talking about what we would call operant learning, and I think that that's central to most habit formation. And I think you also, as you point out, you know, habits may occur in very specific situations. There's an element of what I would call stimulus control there, that you may have learned, for example, that a particular habit is likely to pay off much more under some conditions than others.
Right.
And therefore, when you're back in those conditions.
But it's almost, I don't know, I think it was Charles Duhigg at New York Times, was it New York Times that he works for, that he wrote this, what, The Power of Habit?
Mm-hmm.
That, what did he say, like 40 to 45% of everything we do every day is a habit. So it's as if we are like zombies going through life. You know, it is almost procedural learning, isn't it? That we, like every day I drive to the office, and today, you know, driving to the studio, it was, I take the wrong turn, obviously trying to go to the, you know, turning the wrong way. So it's procedural learning that, so again, it's habit forming that most of the things we do during the day are, if half your day is out of habit, it's scary.
It may be scary, but it's really fairly adaptive that most of the things that we do regularly are habitual. If you think about it, you know, if you drove to the studio or I drove to my office today, we both probably had to stop at a red light more than once.
Right.
And that's basically a very habitual behavior. We identify which light is lit up. We go through all the steps of stopping the car. Yeah, it's not a simple process. I mean, it's not just taking your foot and putting it on the brake. We got to make a lot of observations about how fast we're going and what the other cars are doing and where we want to stop and so forth. But we do all of that and still talk to a passenger or listen to a song on the radio or think about what we're going to do for lunch. So it's adaptive to be able to engage in a lot of activities in a habitual way.
So that's what I was getting to, that there are positive parts of habits as well, that there were that, and like this thing that I talked about in terms of procedural learning, that we have learned, just like when you first learned how to drive your car, that you had full attention to it. And today you're listening to your music and maybe even talking hands-free on the phone and driving and paying attention to the red light and everything else. So it's a, there are habits that we form that are positive and that allow you to navigate through life. So if half the activities that we do are habits that are automated almost, what is happening is that the brain is freeing up the rest of, you know, imagine that if you had to drive your car the way you drove it soon after you passed your driving test, you wouldn't be able to do anything else. So it's kind of allocating the, you know, it's freeing up brain space to be able to learn new things and allocate that brain space to other things. So there is a positive side to habits as well. It's not just the negative part of it. So
sometimes
I think that's absolutely right, that a lot of what we do habitually is very useful and allows us to process other things at the same time. It's when a habit has either carried over from where it's useful to where it's not useful or has begun to involve adverse consequences that we need to look at changing it.
Right. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma, and we're talking about bad habits with the author of the Habit Change Workbook, Dr. James Claiborne, and the founder and president of Lumos Transforms, NChem Indefo. And it, when it comes to the destructive habits, you know, that we're trying to change, NChem, you have a theory about a lot of those behaviors come from trauma. Mm-hmm.
Yep, absolutely. You know, trauma is something that overwhelms us, that's so uncomfortable, that part of us needs to shut it down or disconnect from it. But there are reminders of it everywhere. The smells of it, the, you know, the people, the situations, and we can get triggered. And so we have a lot of uncomfortable feelings that are too big to process. And so we need often things to kind of, habits to go into to not feel. And whether that reaches all the way to the point of an addiction using a substance, but it might be something else. Most of us are addicted to our phones, checking our phones, our faces in our phones.
I am.
Right? I think, you know, honestly, most of us would say yes.
Is there anything I'm not addicted to?
An average adult checks their phone 57 times a day.
Wow. I bet that's low.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
honestly,
that's the average.
Yeah,
right. That's not the people who are addicted, right? Yeah.
Right.
So, but let me ask you this, because part of your practice is mindfulness, right? So if people are trying to not be mindful, that almost seems like a strange thing, is to ask people who are trying to, you know, not be aware, to be more aware of your surroundings, you know, be more aware of what you're doing. How does that work to help you stop doing a behavior that you're doing to not think or feel?
I think it's the habits that people have are the best solution at hand. But usually, if by the time they're showing up, they're motivated enough to say there's some kind of negative consequence and it needs to change. That me checking out, I'm really not present for my kids. Me checking out, I'm really not present for my partner, or myself, or there's negative health consequences. And at that point, they realize, you know what, something has to change. But it's the idea that you have to immediately pay attention to everything that's very painful. That's too much to ask. So can we do it in a stepwise fashion? Can we phase it? Can we make it gentle so that people can come in contact and they need tools to be able to discharge or regulate or settle, so it becomes more and more okay to be present to what's going on? Because it's true. Life has many, many feelings. And if we were always happy, we wouldn't, you know, it would lose its value.
Right. You know, something I think is interesting is, when I quit drinking 8 years ago, I didn't know what I was going to do with myself during the times that I wasn't drinking. You know, I thought, well, now I have to just sit here on the couch and watch TV with my husband, and I'm tense. And I used to use that glass of wine to relax. That was the only thing I knew how to do. And I noticed that because I was very motivated for what you said, I wanted to be present for my kids. I felt like life wasn't going well and alcohol was the culprit. And I was very motivated to change, but I have to say that it was tough. And sometimes you really do have to sit with uncomfortable feelings. And over the years, I've talked to a lot of people who have tried to quit drinking. And a lot of people don't understand that it's not just going to be simple, that you're not going to make a decision to quit doing whatever that behavior is, whether it's taking drugs, drinking. They think, well, once I make that decision, then I need it to kind of be easy. And it's, I think people have to understand, right, that there's going to be an amount of uncomfortability involved in dropping a habit that's been serving a purpose. Mm-hmm.
So acknowledging the need that that habit was serving and saying, is there another way that I can get those needs met?
And also,
is really important.
Yeah, and also that life isn't sort of this perfect box tied up with a bow. And then there are these trials and tribulations we go through. And, you know, there is a... It is tumultuous at times, and you're going to be ratty. It's going to be difficult. And your partner and Stephanie's husband in this case, and I think in the last show as well, we mentioned part of this, that the partner has to understand that the person that you are living with is going to not be this perfect person, that they are going to have their ups and downs. And the part of living together is that understanding and allowing that person to have their ups and downs. And that's what the relationship is about, that you can't be expecting somebody to be perfect and not have that display of emotion. Of course, then again, there's a question of how extreme is that? Then how do you, that, whether that translates into being a borderline or not is another show that we've done in the past.
That's another show. That is actually all the time we have today. This could have gone on for another hour, you guys. Thank you so much for listening. I want to thank our guest, Dr. James Claiborne. Thank you so much. And NChem and Defo. Where can we find you guys? Where can we find you and Defo?
I'm on, we're at lumostransforms.com. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. Please visit us.
Great. And Dr. Claiborne, do you want anyone coming to visit you?
Well, yeah, I have a website. It's drclaiborne.info. Claiborne is C-L-A-I-B-O-R-N. There's no E on the end. Spend a lot of time emailing people with OCD and other problems or whatever else. I'd be glad to talk to folks or email them or whatever.
Okay, great. Thank you guys so much. And next Sunday at 5 p.m., we're going to be talking all about marijuana with Dr. Dawn Davidson and Dr. Wesley Boyd, plus writer Jennifer Valley. If you like what you heard today, You can download this edition of In Your Right Mind as a podcast by going to iTunes or visit inyourrightmind.com to hear this show or previous broadcasts of In Your Right Mind. See you next week.
Good evening.